Spring has sprung, and big savings are in full bloom at Menards. Visit Menards Garden Center for everything you need to get your garden growing. Choose from hundreds of beautiful, colorful flowers, lush trees and shrubs, and everything in between. Menards Garden Center is back in bloom. Stop in today to get your garden on. Check out fresh deals happening now at Menards. Save big money
at Menards. You know, some of the more interesting names, though, you know, they went to talk to Howard Dean to see if he would come back. Howard Dean was a very successful chair in 2008.
He was.
John Tester.
What did Howard Dean say, Matt?
I think Howard Dean said he's probably comfortable doing whatever Howard Dean is doing right now and that he's done that. And,
it was the clearest no that one could say in answer to a question. Hey, friends, welcome back to Trailblaze. I'm Jamal Simmons, and I'm here with my good friend and co-host, Matt Butler. Hey, Matt, how you doing?
I'm fantastic, Jamal. How are you?
I'm good. Welcome to another week of Trailblaze, where we talk about the road to 2028. We're the first podcast to really focus on 2028, although others are now starting to nose around our terrain here. There's a lot going on in Democratic America. Matt, where do you think we should start this week?
A bunch of stuff happening. I feel like things are starting to ramp up this week. We got a lot of kind of endorsement news or not like seeking endorsements. You know, you've got a big story about AOC and ramping her kind of efforts to ramp up what looks like a presidential run. And then we've got the fallout from the DNC releasing its autopsy last week and kind of what's going to happen with Ken Martin at the DNC.
Yeah, okay.
So let's start out of those places.
Sure. Let's start with the presidential primaries, because that's where we always start. So the first one that caught my eye was some very interesting reporting in Axios about AOC's Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez's moving around the country, talking to voters, particularly talking to African-American voters around the country. And after the voting rights cases, Calais in particular, and the redistricting, she seems to be really honing in on that and not trying to cede any ground to anyone else about being at the forefront of that fight.
Yeah, it's a good place for her to be, and it works in with her economic messaging and affordability messaging, because all of these things, when affordability gets really tough, it hits people of color first, and so it's a perfect place for her to be. It's going to be an important area of growth for that sort of Bernie coalition. I mean, I think Bernie had some trouble holding on to African American voters, and if she can get there early and get those onto her side, that's going to be a great way to improve and increase that sort of coalition that almost got Bernie over the line in 2020, but came up just a little bit short when Biden was able to consolidate everybody else.
Yeah, I always think of a Republican colleague who once said to me, I don't think he's all the way wrong, that in the Democratic Party, Black women pick the nominee. In the Republican Party, white men pick the nominee. And the general election, white women have a great say in who gets to be president of the United States. I think it's probably a little bit more mixed than that. That was a decade or so ago. It's a little bit more blended up than that, particularly in the general election, where we've seen more African-American Latino voters in particular having a bigger say. But that's not all the way wrong when you think about where the poles of power sort of lie inside the parties.
Yeah, for sure. I think in 2016, I think that Hillary Clinton expected a lot more support from white women than she actually ended up getting. I mean, she was supported in large numbers, but not as large as they expected. And I think the same was true for Kamala Harris as well.
Look, you know, the two of us, what do we know sitting here talking about this, the two dudes? But I think that history has shown that women voters tend to be less gender voters than like people of color are race voters. You know, so I think we've always expected to see this great outpouring of women support for women candidates. And we haven't seen that yet. I mean, some might argue if that were the case, we would have had a woman president a long time ago. But we haven't seen that yet. And it'll be, I think when we do see women voters, particularly white women voters, begin to vote for women candidates, I think it'll be earth-shattering to the American electorate, regardless of whichever party it is that candidate comes from. So we'll see. Let's move to AOC again, who's out there campaigning. As you said, she is really laying her claim to being the Bernie heir, perhaps, who also has some credibility with people of color. And then there's another Bernie-aligned figure in the Democratic Party in America, which is Elizabeth Warren. And people are paying more attention to Elizabeth Warren these days and chatting her up, even though they may not be talking about it in public.
Yeah. So is Elizabeth Warren obviously did not was not successful in the 2020 race, but there was a kind of large cadre of voters who really, really, really liked what she had to say, like having a plan for everything when we have as many problems as we do. I mean, that was very appealing to people. And so it's natural that people. Yeah, I'm one of them too. I'm a sucker for a plan. So it's natural that people will try to reach out to folks like that who have done this before, who have really wide national recognition to try to get their support. Or if even if it's not to get their support, to sort of freeze their support to make sure they don't go to somebody else. So I think the stories were this week that, you know, Gavin Newsom's been seen having either lunch or coffee with her on a couple of different occasions. She's been out seeing other people around Capitol Hill and stuff like that. So, you know, we have not talked much about endorsements on this podcast. We've talked about raising money, we've talked about organizing, we've talked about building a staff, but the pursuit of big endorsements from either other politicians, figures in state parties, labor unions, those are all going to be incredibly important over the next 18 months as we run up to this primary election. And so it's not surprising that people are trying to woo Elizabeth Warren. So.
Yeah, no, I think that's absolutely right. We are going to see Elizabeth Warren, I think, play a very big role in the upcoming election, because there are a lot of people who really were fond of her the last time she ran. There are a lot of people who the policies make a lot of sense. You know, her analysis of what's going on, it makes a lot of sense. And then some ideas about how do you rein in corporate power, or at least have more transparent corporate power. I mean, that's another thing that we don't talk about enough, I think, as we think about these primaries and what's coming up is, you know, look, the companies employ people, the companies pay taxes in communities, the companies, you know, have a big role to play, but the companies also don't account for all the costs of how they're extracting minerals and resources. They don't necessarily pay their labor as much as what the labor can be worth. They don't necessarily think about the health and safety of some of the products as well as they should. I mean, nobody wants a lawsuit if you're inside of a company, but a lot of times we keep seeing these companies cutting corners. And then we think about AI, it doesn't seem like any of those companies in ways are thinking about the long-term impact of what AI is going to have on the society, even though the great benefits, I use it, the great benefits for it, but we don't know what that means when it comes to jobs. So when you have someone like Elizabeth Warren who's focused on that, I think a lot of people are sympathetic to what she has to say.
Yeah, agree completely. I mean, we have our whole economy set up to reward shareholders, and that's what all companies and corporations that are public are working for. And that's not necessarily the best way to run an economy in terms of the actual people living in that economy. And I think Elizabeth Warren has been at the forefront of these type of issues. I think they play very well into these kind of stuff that AOC is talking about as well. So it seems like that's a more natural sort of connection there. And so it would make sense that Gavin Newsom is trying to curry favor with her and make sure that he is talking to her as much as he possibly can.
And I think there were a couple of others like J.B. Pritzker, I think maybe, and a couple of others who have been really, you know, talking to Warren and figuring out. And you got to believe everybody in the United States Senate, they're a big club. So any of those senators who are thinking about running have something to say. Did we talk about this last week? I went to an event last week with Alyssa Slotkin when I was down in Washington.
I don't think so.
Yeah, I went to an event with Alyssa Slotkin and she talked. I got to tell you, she gave me the warm feeling. I mean, like, she was really, really good. You know, she pushed off the idea of running for president, but she said very clearly that she wanted to be in the mix for changing the image of the party and being one of the people who was the new face of the party to try to get the party, particularly on national security, to have a more forward-leaning facade. And so, you know, they asked her a question about what did she think was the biggest national security threat in America? And she said, the withering middle class. She said, until the country deals with bolstering the middle class and making the middle class as strong and secure as possible, making people believe their children had a brighter future than the one that they had, it's going to be really hard to get people in the country to focus on these other issues around foreign policy and what we need to do abroad to keep ourselves and our allies safe, because people are so worried about their own security. It's hard for them to worry about the broader national security. I just thought, and she leaned right into it. I thought she was just very, very compelling as a figure. And like AOC, I'm sure you won't often hear people say AOC and Elizabeth Slotkin were alike in many ways. But here's how they are alike. When AOC was asked the question of if she wanted to run for president, she said, I'm trying to do something much bigger. I'm trying to change the direction of the country. I got the same feeling from Lissa Slotkin, which is that they were very grounded in who they are, very focused on what they want to do, and willing to accept whatever arrows you want to shoot at them for their agenda. They had a lot of fuck it in their, perspective. And I like that. I like somebody who knows what they believe and is going to fight for it.
Yep. Yeah, you don't want somebody whose just finger is in the wind to try to figure out where, where are my people going so that I can lead them? Like, we don't right. want that. And I think it sounds super smart that, Alyssa Slotkin knows that the economy is going to be the number one issue in this primary. And so for her to be able to figure a way to tie the economy back into her real area of expertise, which is foreign policy, that seems pretty smart and really, really good positioning. But I agree with you completely. I want candidates who know exactly where they are so they can defend those positions. And it's okay. You know what? If you hate my position on universal health care, I don't care. I am still going to stand on that, and that is what I'm going to run. That's what I'm going to run on. And people will start to understand that. People will be in touch with that. Voters can understand kind of when you really stand for something.
They will. They will. And you know what? And if they don't, we know up front, right? Like, if we know up front, we're not going to get along. So let's go ahead and go our separate ways and not do the dance.
Yep.
And I think that is just incredibly compelling as we think about what's happening in the country.
Or you agree that, like, okay, I don't agree with you on that issue, but I know that you're in this place on three other, and I can set that aside, right? I mean, this is George Bush. You may not agree with me, but you know where I stand. And that's when he was completing his contrast to John Kerry, who they tried to paint as a flip-flopper, and in a lot of ways were able to paint him as a flip-flopper and just sort of wishy-washy on issues.
It was a very compelling argument by George W. Bush. This brings us to something that's been roiling Democratic circles for the last week or so, and it does have a big impact not only on what happened in the last election, but what's going to happen perhaps in the next election, which is the autopsy that has come about. People have been talking about for the last few days, a week, and what it means. Let me just say this as we get started. I have known Paul Rivera, who wrote this document. I've known him for a long time. I did some calling around this week, and I got some clear insight about how Paul was thinking about this and what Paul, his view on what happened was. And here's what I can tell you from what I know, is that Paul believes that he was asked for the report that he had that was in his possession when he had it. It was a draft, an early draft, and he was just asked to submit those pages so they could react to them. He would get some insight from what they liked, what they didn't like, where he should continue to go, where he shouldn't, and then he'd move forward from there. I think he also would say that he got some, he hadn't talked to some people, like he didn't talk to people in the campaign because he hadn't gotten that direction and that permission out of the DNC hierarchy yet. And then lastly, I think he'd say that he didn't include things like Joe Biden dropping out and Kamala Harris having 107 days or even Gaza Israel issue, because those were what he would call episodic. They weren't systemic. And he was focused on not just the particulars of the 2024 kind of campaign. There are always those that exist, but the trend lines of Democrats over the last 15 or so years of losing seats, losing, battling for 50.1% of the electorate, 50 plus one. Is that the approach, the right approach? And maybe in 2024, when the winds all blew against us in so many ways, the ways that we weren't campaigning well for the last decade caught up with us, and even facing a convicted felon who had been impeached twice and everybody knew was fundamentally dishonest, we still lost that campaign, despite all the things that were going in our favor, should have been in our favor.
Yeah. And I've known Paul as well. I mean, I think I first time I worked with him was kind of in 1996 when we were getting ready for the presidential inauguration of Bill Clinton after the campaign. Paul is a super smart guy. He is super strategic. He's just one of those guys who kind of gets strategy. And it's I feel like he's been completely thrown under the bus on this whole thing. Now, I've not talked to him. I don't have any insight into it. But that seems like what you see when you read that autopsy report. It's clearly not finished.
Yeah.
And
there are typos. Look, there are typos and some errors and dates and names and whatever.
What do you know about Paul?
He's
not going to turn in a piece of shit as a final product. He's definitely not.
Right.
He is a professional campaign operative and political operative. It seems like he turned it in. Maybe they didn't like the direction of it. Maybe they thought it was like too off base. Maybe they didn't like that there weren't citations and stuff like that. But that if you're going to make the decision, okay, we're not going down this path anymore, you need to announce that. You need not just say, well, we're only going to look at the lessons. And so Ken now has just screwed this guy and then put this piece of paper out that wasn't a final product. It's pretty upsetting to see what he's done. And, you know, I was supportive early on of Ken, early on in this podcast. I thought they were doing a good job and doing what the DNC needed to do. But this is too much. Like, it's too much. We've got to move on. So,
yeah, And look, they've had 6 months, right? So let's say they got the document from Paul. They didn't like the document they got. So they've had 6 months since they've had that. So what are you going to do with it, right? Are you just not going to have an autopsy or some look back to figure it out? Are you going to go back to the document you have? Is there anything here that's useful? They did a lot of editing to tell us what wasn't useful, but they don't really say like, oh, this actually is really important.
Right.
And so I just think if we're going to, and Ken Martin has been saying, Chairman Martin has been saying that he's been using the document to make decisions about what's, you know, going forward.
Yeah.
I mean, he said that. I didn't say that. He said that he was using the document. So I want to know what in the document did he find useful, right? We know what they don't like, but what's in the document they found useful? I think that would be helpful for people to know as we're going forward. I'll tell you one thing that I found useful. When he says in the document, he says something about Democrats need to learn how to always be on, not just always late, right? The Republicans have learned to communicate all the time and in new and different ways. And while we may be spending money or even outspending them, we're spending the money at the wrong time and in the wrong ways. And we've got to really think about not just trying to deluge the system in the last like 4 or 5 months, but like, how do we always get our message across? I thought that was super important.
That makes a ton of sense. And also not the winning the elections by 50% plus one. I mean, we have got some huge intractable problems in this country. We need to win by large margins so that we have the mandate to make some real fundamental changes in the way this country does democracy, the way that it does campaign finance. It gets money out of politics, gets rid of Citizens United. And you're not going to do that by just kind of just getting over the edge in Michigan, Pennsylvania, and Wisconsin and winning by a total margin of, 150,000 votes. Like that's not what we need. We need big ideas and really big. And so he's spot on with that.
I think he used a phrase on your point, Matt. He uses a phrase called organize everywhere so we can win anywhere.
Yeah.
I will say the
criticism, I do like the way that Ken has been setting up the organizing program and getting us everywhere. I will say was this kind of thing of like, hey, we sent more money to Guam or one of the territories than we did to Wisconsin last month. Like, I don't think we should be putting money into those territories. Like, even if it's like, I mean, it's like if it's $10,000 a month, that's $60,000 a month that we just do not need. They don't have electoral votes. They don't have representation in Congress. Like, we are in a place where all the money needs to go to the right places. So you give them a little bit of support, but they should not be getting the same support that you're giving other states. So that's, I think, a problem with kind of Martin's analysis. The other thing, just kind of as a side note, you're in the chair now. Why don't we see the 2016 autopsy that wasn't released? I mean, somebody's got that. I'm sure it's in that building. Let's see that. Like, what happened there? Why haven't we seen that? He criticized the DNC in his run for chair for not releasing the 2016 autopsy. So let's see what that says too. I think there's going to be some interesting information as well.
And then there's a fundamental question. questions yeah. about, like, where did all that money go? I mean, they spent $1.1 or so billion dollars, and I think there might be some pointers in that document, but we haven't gotten all of it, which is, where was the money spent? Which firms got it? What did they do with it? You know, I will tell you what I discovered in the 2024 election, which was people were calling me all the time once Kamala Harris became the nominee. People were calling me asking me to volunteer, and I would try to connect them with people in states, find somebody in the campaign to, you know, plug people in. What's the right website to go to? I will tell you, they didn't have that built out. They were not ready to deal with all the people who could come in and support. And one person told me he was inside the campaign. One person told me, you know what? We really didn't have a great volunteer system because Joe Biden didn't have that many volunteers. So we didn't really spend a lot of time on volunteering, on building that mechanism. And so when Kamala Harris came and the volunteer, you know, interest shot up, they really didn't have a bottle to catch that lightning. And it showed. People like sort of drifted away. They were really excited and they kind of drifted away because nobody called them back.
Yeah. I mean, I tried to go out for the last couple of weeks to either Wisconsin or Pennsylvania, and I was not able to get a call back to figure out where exactly I would go and be able to be plugged in to do, you know, more than just sort of door knocking and kind of phone calls and stuff like that. I mean, we did end up going door knocking in Pennsylvania towards the end, but, you know, it would have been a great thing. I mean, I had the time off. I could have gone to give them 2 or 3 weeks at the end. So, but you know, look, I'm not super worried about that because, you know, 107 days, like, I mean, it's really hard to get that. Biden should have had it set up, but, you know, maybe it just kind of fell by the wayside over the summer when they were supposed to be doing that. And we're like, well, who's going to be our candidate?
No, I actually think it was worse than this, Matt. I think that what was happening was they weren't telling us the truth. I think they had been building a campaign. Another person told me inside the campaign that they had all these field offices. You know, we always announce, you know, new field offices opened in these states and so many field offices around the country. Biden was very interested in knowing what the field offices were. And then it turned out that there was nobody in a lot of those field offices. They just had real estate. And so really they were paying for offices with signs on the windows and doors, but they didn't even have people in those offices to man them. There was no grassroots organization. So in many ways, it was like this Potemkin village, and it makes you wonder how soon people in the campaign knew that they were in trouble versus the rest of us who thought maybe the campaign, you know, was maybe having some hiccups and bumps, but was, you know, fundamentally like on a path to win. Did they always know that, or were they kind of just going through the motions? I don't know. I don't know the answer to that question.
Yeah, and it sounds like, you know, look, I mean, we can talk about the autopsy that was done and kind of where Paul was. Like, that's not a volunteer operation. Like, no. You can't, I mean, how can you expect a volunteer to produce a 200-page document that's like analyzing? I mean, what was the total spend from all the different organizations and super PACs? It's like $7.5 billion. Like, you're not going to spend $300,000 or $400,000 to get a really, really deep dive into what happened. And that's 100% Ken's decision. And I know that the DNC has money trouble, but, like, you know, you got to do that. You got to do that in the 6 months after the election while the stuff is fresh. You got to talk to everybody. And it would have been very helpful. And if you really want lessons for the future, doing a real autopsy would have been able to get us that. So, I mean, I guess the question is kind of where we go from here with Ken. So,
you've run organizations. I've run teams. I got to tell you, of parts of organizations, the one thing that I know from good leaders is that when you take over an organization, it is in your interest to let people know how bad things are inside. Oh, yeah. If there are bad things in that organization, let people know what those bad things are so that you don't, one, get the weight of the bad things that you inherited. And then two, afterwards, frankly, like, you can over-deliver. Everything that you do is an improvement upon the previous version. Now Ken Martin's in this horrible position where not only is he in trouble about the autopsy, when and where, it's almost like he owns a 2024 debacle. And he wasn't even there. He wasn't even in the office. And yet, you know, he kind of is the person carrying around the weight of that debacle.
You know, I don't know. He's in a bad spot, and I don't think it's going to get any better. I don't think that he can recover. Lauren Egan has an interesting piece in the Bulwark talking about kind of who could potentially step in and who people are talking to. And apparently there are some operatives out there that are kind of like kind of plumbing the waters. You know, some of the more interesting names, though, you know, they went to talk to Howard Dean to see if he would come back. Howard Dean was a very successful chair in 2008.
He was.
John Tester,
you know, Howard Dean say? What did Howard Dean say, Matt?
I think Howard Dean said he's probably comfortable doing whatever Howard Dean is doing right now and that he's done that.
It was the clearest no that one could say in answer to a question.
You know, look, and a lot of people have talked about Ben Wickler, you know, the person who was closest to running against Ken Martin. You know, I know Ben well and I've known him for at least 15 years. I supported him in his race for chair. But the DNC decided to go a different way. And now it would be a terrible idea for Ben to come in. I mean, his whole thing was, we're going to change the DNC. We are going to really do things in a completely and totally new way. And at this point now, he's lost 18 months of that. So you basically just have to take over Ken Martin's plan. You know, the election's, you know, less than 6 months away. And then you've got 2028 coming right up. So he's not going to be able to be successful in doing all the different things that he wanted to do. He obviously did not have the support of the majority of the members of the Democratic National Committee. And so, you know, they weren't interested in being a change organization. So to come back to him now, it's like, it's unfair. And it'd just be a terrible move on his part. So I don't blame him for saying no. You know, I thought some of the interest, there were some other interesting names on that list, though. Stephanie Shriok, who used to run Emily's List. I think she could be really interesting. Beto O'Rourke. You know, kind of in the sort of, you know, hey, I'm a pretty good communicator who got some national attention. You know, New Mexico Governor Grisham, you know, that would have to be sort of that old school 95, 96, where you have like a general chair and a national chair, right? So like
we had Don Rindell, Fowler.
Don Fowler came as a state chair and Chris Dodd was his general chair.
Right.
So you could have, you could see a setup sort of like that. But like, you know, if you're the governor of a major state, you don't have time to be the DNC chair.
No, you don't. You cannot do that Julie job Castro, and do two jobs at the same time. We've seen that tried a few times and it's not great.
Yeah, it's not great. I mean, look, I'm still on this Pete Buttigieg thing. I mean, I could be, you know,
But our friend, has anybody called the Macker?
Oh, Terry, what's he doing?
McAuliffe doing?
Put Terry McAuliffe back in the
building.
That is a great, great idea. But you know who they did call was, it sounds like they called our friend Amanda Littman. And you know, she would have been, you want new and different. She would have been awesome. She would have been an amazing chair. She said no, though. She already has her own organization and she is doing great. So, but yeah, I think it's interesting. So we got to find somebody to try to take the job. And it sounds like that's what's keeping Ken in his job right now, is that they don't have sort of a consensus candidate who also wants the job.
Yeah, there's not another horse. I think the thing about the DNC chair's job, you've been in that building, I've been in that building, is that a big chunk of that job is the care and feeding of Democratic committee members, state party chairs around the country, all the other committee members, the at-large folks, figuring out a lot of the just knitting together of holding this big behemoth organization together. And, you know, I think the public thinks your job is to go out and argue for Democratic causes and fights and, you know, and go raise money and be there. And that's a big chunk of the job. But it's also not a policy job. That's the other thing that I think when you're not in office, the DNC chair is not a policy person. That's Hakeem Jeffries' job. That's Chuck Schumer's job is to come up with policy. That's each one of these candidates' job. That's the Democratic governors. They're the ones who do the policy. The DNC chair does politics. They build organizations. They fund media plans. They raise money for candidates and campaigns. They don't really do policy.
Right. That's exactly right. And I think maybe, you know, if somebody's going to be successful in this job, like as I've also all like said for a long time, the DNC chair job is a terrible job, but it doesn't have to be. In the hands of the right person who can help educate the public so that they understand what the DNC chair is supposed to do and not do, you really could take that place because there are some amazingly dedicated, hardworking, smart people in that building, some of whom have been there for a very long time, have great institutional experience. So, you know, it could be a really, really great job in the hands of the right person. And I think maybe Ken is not the right person for it to be in right now. So we'll need to move on.
And you know, I think the idea of having a big name that can come in and throw that name around to make things move might be also important, right? So it might, in normal times, it might be great to get a state party chair or get somebody who's like an operative who could do it. I am a huge fan of Stephanie Shriok. I think maybe she is one of the people who might be able to thread the needle a little bit because she does have national standing. But I think you've got to have people who, someone who people will listen to and someone who will go out around the country and argue the case for Democrats. Because I think that's what the people in the party want. They don't care about the minutiae. They just want you to get out there and tell me something that's going to give me ammo in my fight with these, you know, verbal ways to fight with Republicans at work, fight with Republicans online, fight with Republicans, you know, wherever they encounter them. They just want to feel better about the Democratic position and push back on the Republican narrative.
Pete Buttigieg. I mean, it's crying out for Pete Buttigieg. He'd be an amazing chair.
That's how we met him. It might be how his time has come.
It is. It's great.
Pete, so, your time has come.
I know you want to be president. I get it. It's a bit of a more respected job. Like I'm not going to complain too much that or push back too much on the president would be a better job than being DNC chair, but it's a lot harder to get the job of president than it is to get that job of DNC chair. I mean, all he has to do is call the operatives and say yes, and he's got that job. So
all he's got to do is snap his fingers. And look, DNC chair could end up landing him in a really plum. He's already had a cabinet position. He could have another one. He could be White House chief of staff. I mean, he was a member of Congress, but he also was a DCCC chair, which gave him a lot of power with Congress, which is how he ended up being the White House chief of staff. You know, Ron Brown, who had been DNC chair before, ended up going to be Commerce Secretary, and he basically turned the Commerce Department into like the economic State Department, right? Like no one ever thought of the Commerce Department as this great place, but Brown turned it into like, he used the force of his personality and his political relationships to turn it into like an economic powerhouse inside the Clinton administration. So, you know, there are things you can do with the job if you're creative. And I think Buttigieg could be creative enough to do it.
Yeah. And look, I mean, you had Ron Brown who won a major presidential election. Howard Dean won a major presidential election. Like there is some glory to be had there. And I think that glory is possibly there in 2028 if we can, you know, get us over the line. Okay, well. We'll see.
We will see. I do want to sum up on this idea of the autopsy. You know, look, it's got typos. It's got some stuff that I understand why people are harping on them, but I've been in communications for a long time. And I'll just say, I can smell a comms plan oppo from a mile away. And it does feel like the desire to talk about what's wrong with the plan, the nits that are wrong with the plan are getting us away from talking about the substantive points that are really important about how it is Democrats campaign, where Democrats campaign, how we spend our money. Are we still recycling the same consultants who are working cycle after cycle, whether they win or they lose? You know, is all the money going through the same organizations that are just feeding it out? Do the people who are getting hired actually know what they're doing? That the campaigns, are they thinking differently about social media and digital media than they were? Are they still rooted in the old legacy media? I mean, they're like real questions to ask about
real hard questions. Campaigns. Yeah.
Yeah. So I would advise people download it, get the DNC plan, download it. Get past the first sections, like get past all the stuff, all the red lines, but look at the parts that are talking about kind of the substantive parts of what happened in the campaign. They're there. Don't get sidetracked. They're there, and I think you can find it.
Yeah, and also don't get sidetracked by, like, there's a lot of things where it says, you know, this no evidence to support this. But that doesn't mean that the thing isn't true.
Absolutely.
Right? Like, so it's not like there's no evidence and it's wrong. Like, no, but this is actually, there's a bunch of, like, stuff in there that, I assume that Paul had evidence for all of that stuff or he wouldn't have put it in, but...
My understanding is that he does have a lot of backup. He does have a lot of backup. Yeah. He had an early draft that he sent that did not have all the citations because, you know, it's like you're writing the first draft. Right. And so you haven't put all the bibliography together, but.
Yeah. And then for them to put it out in this way and just saying like this was it. And especially if Paul was supposed to be one of Ken's friends and like that's the reason he was doing this because they were friends. I mean, that's like such a shitty thing to do to a friend. I mean, I'm sorry. Like step up, take the hit. It's your fault. Like just own it. So.
Anyway. Well, I will say that, you know, look, I don't know about I don't know exactly how the conversations happened, but I will say this. I have been in rooms. I can tell you. I'll just tell you. I've been in rooms in the White House where bosses have asked me questions about things that have gone wrong. And I could have said, oh, it was this person on my team who made this mistake. And instead of doing that, I said, it's my team. I made the mistake. I'll fix it. Right? Like it was me. It was our team. I'm responsible. I'm the one who lead this team. It's me. I'm responsible. Hold it against me. If I don't get it right, you know, do whatever you need to do with me. I think that's what people need in our party. Like we do in our country.
Yeah.
We need people who are going to, you know, take the bull by the horns, take mistakes when they happen, own the mistakes, share the responsibility, share the glory when those things happen. You know, it wasn't me. It was my team that did all the work. If the mistakes happen, no, it wasn't my team. It was me. Like that is the kind of leadership that I was always taught that you're supposed to have when you run an organization.
Yeah. And it's so important to have that at the DNC right now because their job is incredibly important. So,
yeah.
We'll see. Okay.
We will see. All right, Matt, good to talk to you this week.
Great to talk to you, Jamal.